Was the severity of Hurricane Helene a product of climate change or environmental modification technology? Is there more to global warming than system-wide burning of fossil fuels? Is it a coincidence that current financial climate solutions advantage the very wealthy at the expense of average humans? Who is Mark Carney, and why is he poised to move from the UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance to Trudeau's successor as Prime Minister of Canada? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with the 29th UN Conference of the Parties underway, preparing to save the day for the planet, we host an analysis of some of the factors other than fossil fuels influencing global climate change, and also take a look at what major financial eco-warriors are really doing behind the curtain of mainstream media spotlight. In our first half hour, we hear a report by Greg Reese on the probable use of NMOD strategies and the motive of supplying the U.S. with access to lithium that was responsible for the devastation in North Carolina last month. We hear from writer-blogger Dmitry Orlov on the cause of climate change as rooted in the heavens rather than the earth. And in our final half hour, Matthew Arrett, editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review, joins us to discuss the rise of Canadian banker Mark Carney and his role in forging ahead with a world government and the depopulation of the planet. On this week's program, COP29, the Great Reset of the Climate Apocalypse, taxing the people to feed the banks. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 15th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The resources shared between First Nations and settlers came via broken treaties, faulty promises, and force, all of which contributed to colonialism and genocide of Indigenous people. And we seek to correct these injustices moving forward through acknowledging the crimes, reparations, and reconciliation, and moving forward with mutual respect and partnership. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. We see a clip of JFK himself condemning the U.S. support of the Cuban dictator Batista, who was finally overthrown by Fidel Castro and his rebel compatriots, the Cuban Revolution that Kennedy understood and sympathized with. All this just leading up to Kennedy's presidency, which will be covered in the next film. Watching this riveting documentary, one cannot but be deeply impressed with a side of John Kennedy few know, his hatred of oppression, colonialism, imperialism, war, and his love of freedom for all people. One comes away from the film knowing full well why the CIA had branded him an arch enemy even before he took office, and then, when in office, he rattled their cage so much more in the cause of peace. And one is left asking, why then has this film and its predecessor about the right-wing witch hunt and crackdown on dissent in the 1950s not been released to the public at a time when nothing could be more timely? That comes from the article, John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, A Bizarre Kind of Executive Action, The Suppression of Epochal Documentaries, Edward Curtin. By Edward Curtin, posted November 14th, originally published on the author's blog site, Behind the Curtain. Here comes a relatively simple solutions for the three world powers, Washington, Russia, Beijing, to act in unison and to stop the killing, destruction, and misery at once. Now that the U.S. ultimatum expired, these three world powers could simply occupy Israel with minimal casualties, block deliveries of fuel, food, medication, water supply, much of which belongs to Palestine anyway, and of course weapons and money, all blocked at once. From one day to the other, the killing would stop. Or is somebody telling the world that there are powers, obviously Zionists or Zionist-associated supremacies, that are above the United States, Russia, and China? That comes from the article, Appeal to the Superpowers, Stop the Zionist-Israeli Genocide at Once, by Peter Koenig, posted November 14th. Even within the imperialist states, such as the U.S., Britain, and the European Union, or EU, countries, there is growing support for the cause of the Palestinians. Demonstrations demanding the full disclosure and disinvestment from Israel and those conducting business with the racist regime are involving millions of youths and workers. The concluding declaration of the Arab League OIC meeting encompassed 38 resolutions, two of which read, quote, to start working to mobilize international support to suspend Israel's participation in the United Nations General Assembly and all its affiliated entities in preparation for submitting a joint draft resolution to the General Assembly, the 10th Special Session, Uniting for Peace, on the basis of its violations of the United Nations Charter, its threat to international peace and security, and its failure to fulfill its membership in the United Nations, and based on the advisory opinion issued by the International Court of Justice on July 19, 2024, to call on all countries to ban the export or transfer of weapons and ammunition to Israel, urging countries to join the initiative proposed by the Republic of Turkey and the core group consisting of 18 countries, which was signed by 52 countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the League of Arab States, and to send a joint letter to the UN Security Council, the President of the UN General Assembly, and the UN Secretary General, to halt the provision of arms to Israel and to invite all countries to sign it, unquote. That comes from the article, Joint Extraordinary Summit Between the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League Calls for Embargo Against Israel, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted November 14th. The jury awarded a total of $42 million to three Iraqi men, a journalist, a middle school principal, and fruit vendor, who were held at the notorious prison two decades ago. The plaintiff's suit accused Virginia-based Khaki, which was hired by the U.S. government to provide interrogation services at Abu Ghraib, of conspiring with American soldiers to torture detainees. Tuesday's verdict marks a rare victory for plaintiffs seeking to bring American corporations to justice for playing a part in the country's so-called war on terror. What the jury did today is send a very clear message that the contractors who go to war or go work with the government overseas, they will be held accountable for their role in whatever violations their employees may commit, said Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented the plaintiffs at a press conference on Tuesday afternoon. They need to have far better oversight over their employees to ensure that something like what happened at Abu Ghraib never happens again. That comes from the article, Abu Ghraib detainees awarded $42 million in torture trial against Virginia-based Khaki, by Sanya Mansour, posted November 14th, originally published on The Intercept. Trump values loyalty above all else. In the 2020 race, Netanyahu publicly supported Joe Biden and urged the thousands of U.S. citizens living in Israel to vote for Biden. Trump may make demands on Netanyahu for a peace plan for Palestine, which Smotrich and Ben-Gvir refuse, which will be followed by the collapse of the Netanyahu coalition. Netanyahu would then face prison for his corruption conviction, and a new Israeli government would be formed. A new Israeli government, post-Netanyahu, might be willing to compromise for Israeli peace and security, and a two-state solution would be possible. That comes from the article, Trump's Partner for Peace in the Middle East, by Stephen Swahini, posted November 14th, originally published on Mideast Discourse. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The 29th Annual Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework on Combating Climate Change began on Monday, November 11th, and was hosted in Baku, Azerbaijan. One of the achievements of the first week was the reaching of a consensus on the creation of carbon credits under Article 6.4 of the Paris Agreement, thereby ensuring demand for carbon credits and ushering in an international carbon market. Carbon markets are seen as a way of establishing a trading system where carbon credits are sold and bought. If a company or individual produces too much carbon dioxide, they can purchase a carbon credit from another company or individual that has effectively reduced or removed the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions. Carbon financing is considered the key to the implementation of national determined contributions, or NDCs. There is demand for carbon markets. Greenhouse gas warming is seen as the main and only factor in climate change and carbon markets. It is argued is the answer to addressing it, but other factors are not really considered. One factor that is not mentioned at all in modern climate talks is environmental modification techniques, or NMOD. These techniques do exist and have been applied by the U.S. military for more than half a century. There was even a convention in 1977 on the use of NMOD, banning military or hostile use of environmental modification techniques having widespread, long-lasting, or severe effects. Can we really assume these powerful techniques are not mentioned in light of current dramatic meteorological events such as hurricanes? On October 2nd, writer and researcher Greg Rees put together a report for InfoWars on the history of the U.S. officially learning how to steer hurricanes. He mentions that Project Cirrus, run by General Electric and supported by the U.S. military, was the first official attempt to modify a hurricane by seeding the wall outside of the eye with compounds like silver iodide. On October 13th, 1947, a hurricane headed out to sea was seeded with 180 pounds of dry ice. Modification was observed, and the hurricane shifted direction, landing on Savannah, Georgia. In 1965, a similar operation, Project Storm Fury, targeted Hurricane Betsy, and again it changed direction and landed in Southern California. Now, importantly, in 1997, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen admitted to the use of technology for controlling not only weather, but earthquakes and volcanoes. The U.S. government put a gag order on employees of the National Weather Service. Another hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, in 2012, had weakened to a tropical storm, but microwave technology reveals a thick red beam followed by Sandy strengthening to a Category 1 hurricane and again shifting toward New Jersey. Enter Hurricane Helene. Last month it was steered toward King Mountain in North Carolina. North Carolina is believed to be one of the biggest resources of lithium in the world, at a time when there is a kind of gold rush for this mineral for fueling alternative energy sources to fossil fuels. According to a reporter, people don't want to leave the town, and it's considered a divisive issue among the small, quiet town of Cherryville. It is interesting that the previous year, 2023, the Department of Defense secured a $90 million agreement with Albemarle Corporation to increase domestic production of lithium for the nation's battery supply chain, specifically from King Mountain, to start in 2025. How did the Department of Defense know a disaster would strike the community and force everyone out? There is another researcher who has expressed doubts about carbon dioxide as the prime culprit in global warming. Dmitry Orlov emigrated from Russia, where he was born, to the United States in the mid-1970s. He's moved back to Russia in recent years. He is the author of Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies that Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom, and The Five Stages of Collapse, Survival's Toolkit. And he blogs at boosty.to/clubOrlov. I engaged him in conversation recently about his current hypothesis and efforts by elites to usher in carbon markets under the guise of protecting the planet.
A lot of talk about how we're going to get carbon dioxide under control to protect the planet from global warming. And it seems as if you too were concerned about this theory of climate change when you wrote the Shrinking the Technosphere. Yet you recently, the last couple of years, you revised your analysis of the global warming and concluded that increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was not the main cause of rising temperatures. What exactly was it that caused you to change your views?
What caused me to change my views was moving from the United States, where anything that contradicts the global warming carbon dioxide hypothesis — it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis — is basically taboo and gets you shunned. Moving to Russia, where just about anything can be discussed, and where scientists are more free to speak their minds, although not on paper, because they don't want to be shunned internationally. After all, this global warming mafia is really quite powerful. Now, the whole scheme was that the West, or the developed countries of the West, would pursue the strategy of using solar and wind, which only they would be able to afford, and which would be successfully used, whereas the rest of the world would muddle along with fossil fuels and would be heavily fined for doing so, for causing quote-unquote global warming or catastrophic climate change or something like that. And in order to support this juggernaut, all kinds of scientific forgeries were committed and are being committed. Now, the way it turned out was that the solar panels and the wind generators all had to be Chinese made, and they're non-renewable resources because they have to be renewed quite regularly by the Chinese. If the Chinese don't sell the equipment or the precursors to the equipment, which is a lot of rare earths that only the Chinese have, then no more renewable energy. And then Western countries also committed all kinds of grave errors, such as getting rid of nuclear, such as shutting down pipelines from Russia to the West, and generally trying to get rid of Russian exports, energy exports, which just basically means that Russian oil goes through India now at a markup. So they did all sorts of ridiculous things. But in terms of the global warming hypothesis and the idea that carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations are a leading as opposed to a trailing phenomenon of global warming, that's just a hypothesis. It hasn't been proven. It's not a very good hypothesis. The most potent global warming gas is water vapor, which is very badly, clouds, that is, which is very badly modeled in all of these catastrophist models of global warming. And carbon dioxide, it just isn't very, very effective. And the other thing, the thing that absolutely kills all of these claims that higher carbon dioxide concentrations have raised the temperature, is that the temperature has gone up on other planets as well, on which there is no carbon dioxide and no humans and no industry. And so that would point out to some kind of a space-related source of radiation, which heated up planetary cores. And the Russians have also done some research because they're afraid of being ostracized. Unfortunately, it's been circulated but unpublished. That the warming on Earth has been from the core of the planet. That is, the ocean is warming throughout its depth, which is not what you expect from atmospheric warming. And so all of that put together just basically means that this COP initiative and the rest of this global warming carbon dioxide juggernaut that is still being pursued by the West is basically just a complete and total disaster.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems as if, I mean, the idea of a peer-reviewed paper literature and scientific journalism is elevated in my mind here in the Anglo-American West, but I don't know, like they say there's a 99% consensus of human activities causing climate change. I don't know, as somebody who's you know been in the sciences yourself, how do you, I don't know, defend being a member of this extreme minority of scientists? I mean, how is it that this peer-reviewed system does not necessarily align with your thoughts and on all the evidence that you point to?
Well, first of all, I don't have to defend it. You can take it or leave it. Secondly, you don't really have to get into the details of who these peers are to point out the really obvious thing, which is climate science is boring. Climate just changes and nobody knows why, and there's no way to explain it. And so it's a waste of time to study it, because it's basically you're just recording what's going on without any ability to explain it. But if you want to get some grants, then you have to talk up climate catastrophism. So anybody who is in climate science is a climate catastrophist, or they don't get served lunch. That's how science works in the West. So they're a bunch of lunch eaters. And of course, that they're going to tell you that the climate is going to the dogs and we are to blame, because that's what they get paid to do.
Yeah, well, you suggest in your hypothesis, suggesting that the planet is warming from the core and not from the atmosphere. I mean, is there a certain a bit of research that confirms that, or like a certain paper that was written? I mean, what was?
Yeah, there's plenty of research, but nobody's going to put their name to it, because we know how the system works. Science is an international pursuit, and the thing is that all of the people who control access happen to be in the West, and happen to be in on it. So there's research, but it's not going to be published in a way that you will accept, for obvious political reasons.
Okay, in terms of the I guess the space-based, like you mentioned, the other planets were heating up. I mean, what exactly is that? The source of that space-based event, is it something from the sun or something beyond? What? I mean, I know it's still a hypothesis, but what would cause something like that?
Well, the warming effect, the pulse, is observable. and has been measured. It's hard to measure it on the outer planets, but it's been recorded on the Moon, on Mars, and on Venus. Nobody knows what exactly happened because nobody was tooled up to actually measure the particle flux as it happened. But chances are that it's an increased neutrino flux that could be from out that probably is from outside the solar system. There are various mechanisms, some understood, such as a supernova, some much worse understood, that cause increases in neutrino flux for periods of time. And it's notoriously difficult to observe because neutrinos don't really interact with matter very much. So that is one theory that's been proposed, but this is not something that happens very often. It seems to have run its course already. Nobody observed it while it was happening, and now it seems to be over.
Yeah. Well, given all of this, I mean, and why would you suggest that carbon and fossil fuels are such a major focus of these UN climate change policies? I mean, what's enacting that and has been for some time, like going back to, more than 30 years.
Oh, it's very simple. These countries that w are behind this effort still feel like they can control the whole world. And the idea was that, well, we in the West have the capacity to shift to quote unquote renewables. As I explained, they aren't renewable. They're renewable by the Chinese for money. They wear out. They thought that they could shift to renewables and be these magic elves that don't emit carbon dioxide, and then everybody else in the world who have to burn whatever's available in order to cook their dinner could be taxed for doing so and fined. And so the West is always looking for ways to rob the rest of the planet, and this was just one of them.
So you guess things like the carbon, there's a carbon market now where you basically have you could use the certain plants as ways of as being mitigants to fossil fuel production. So we're still producing fossil fuels anyway, but we're growing a certain plant, and that way we're contributing this to this carbon market, and that's that in itself has certain implications, right?
Yeah, well, the biggest implication of that is that Russia would be the biggest recipient of money from this carbon market because Russia has the most boreal forest in the world, and so it is capturing more carbon dioxide than the rest of the planet put together. So just take all your money and send it to Russia. And since that plan didn't really appeal to Western countries, Russia had to somehow be finessed or excluded.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure interacting with you again, Dimitri. Thank you for joining us and sharing your analysis with our listeners.
Thank you.
Dimitri Orlov is the author of Shrinking the Technosphere: Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom, and Five Steps of Collapse: Survivor's Toolkit, as well as Reinventing Collapse: The Soviet Experience and American Prospects.
Dmitry Orlov lives in St. Petersburg. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. A figure on the world stage who is a major architect of a climate-friendly solution to the way the financial system works is Mark Carney. He works as the Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance. He was the former chair of the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada, and he may soon replace Justin Trudeau as the next leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. But in a September 12th article written by Matthew Errett, Carney is a major figure at the helm of orchestrating the Great Reset that would alter the whole way that the global financial system works, and not for large segments of the working class, with aims to that have nothing to do with healing the planet. Is Mark Carney a climate sheep in profit predator bankers wolf's clothing? Matthew Arrett is the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review, senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, and director of the Rising Tide Foundation. He has written the four-volume Untold History of Canada series, a four-volume Clash of the Two Americas series, and the Science Unshackled, Restoring Casualty to a World in Chaos. He's also the co-host of the Multipolar Reality on Rogue News and Breaking History on Badlands Media. It's good to have you back. Thanks again for joining us, Matt. So, for years, environmental activists have said that we have to stop investing in financing fuel industries that are ravaging the earth and invest instead in new technologies such as solar and wind power, green solutions. And Mark Carney has played a major role in developing financial tools and in responding positively to these changes, or so we think. What's wrong with that?
Thank you.
Yeah, it seems like you're suggesting that this whole the response on the part of, I guess, what's COP29 as it's coming along, and all of the climate solutions, it's more of a kind of a Hegelian thing, the problem action solution, and the solution is already something that's that they don't emphasize all the toxic impacts of all the things that you're saying in the name of stopping this evil climate change scenario. I know that most of the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually produced by the world's richest people, and yet the Green New Deal reforms are actually, in the words of the Great Reset, that will cover for the, as you say, for the global depopulation, and the world government will be run by the same arsonists, if you will, who lit the world economy on fire in the first place. Could you get it, maybe, how this new version of capitalism will affect changes not in the best interest of the common man and woman? Thank you. Let me just stop you there, if I may. Because I think a major, as you point out, I mean, a major concern of the COP29 summit is going to be financing and making sure that the global South countries, in particular, are, have a kind of a more of leeway than, and I'm wondering. I mean, are you saying essentially that with Carney himself, the major architect coming from the Anglo-American sphere, he was a banker and so forth. Is it truly going to result in an equalizing things in any way, or are we going to see things turning for the worse, from bad to worse?
Thank you.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and my special guest is Matthew Ederett, who's the author and journalist working in Montreal. Matt, I wonder if you could just give our listeners a bit of a brief bio of the man himself, Mark Carney. What brought this boy from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, all of a sudden to calling the shots on global financing?
Thank you.
Wow. Well, I guess that's my next question is that like why would he be seeking to because as you stated right in your article that he's going to replace Trudeau as leader of the party, and I mean he's after being a kind of a puppeteer, because all of these people that you mentioned are so far like puppets essentially. Why would he consent to being a mere prime minister? I mean, I mean, when you consider that, especially when you consider that after the next election, I mean, judging by the polls, the next, no matter who the leader of the Liberal Party is, he's going to be ending up sitting in opposition. Do you have any insights into that? Yeah, I'm gonna call this our last question. We've got to wrap it up pretty soon. But I mean, right now, Trump is the president of the United States, and he's going to be bowing out of the climate agreement. And I think the next leader of the of Canada, you know, in the next year probably will be Pierre Poilievre, who's all against the green financing system. But do you really believe that the likelihood that this green finance initiative will succeed in spite of the bent of all the major you know, the direction that the future leaders seem to be going? Okay. Appreciate this discussion we had today. Thank you so much for participating. We've been speaking to Montreal-based journalist, author, and researcher Matthew Errett. You could read his work at the site CanadianPatriot.org. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.